such a privilege to share the platform with you. Thank you. I love you. Good morning. Well, look at us all here multiplying. And once again, prayer is so good. We just double the numbers of seats in seats when we close our eyes to pray. I really like how that works. Once again, I would just like to welcome you to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living. And I'm Reverend Karen Rice. And I've got something to say today. I do. And how about that Andy? Thank you, Andy. Let's give him some love. You know, Andy hasn't been hanging around that long before we recruited him for a big, important job. And thank you so much for saying yes. It's been really fun to see the different expressions of and ways we can announce things and keep things spiced up. Are you on next week, Rosie? Whoa, we can't wait to see what Rosie's going to do. Have some fun. So Rosie, by the way, of all our announcers, Rosie is the only female. Do you think there was a message here in the selection of getting... So we're mixing up the platform energy so it's a little more balanced, but me and Rosie are going to do our part, right? We really are. So welcome to another gorgeous Sunday morning in the West Valley. And I'm talking today on this idea. The title of the message is Only One. And my goodness, what a glorious job the reading and the prayer and the music all is just fitting together, as it often does in this way where we just complement the idea of really what I want to say this morning. And we are continuing on in this beautiful theme of this year-long journey of looking at the possibility of believing in a world that works for everyone, for every living being, and that how important it is that as each and every one of us just plays with that idea of just thinking about the possibility that we create something expansive in consciousness that is greater than what we have ever seen happen on this planet yet. And so I'm really thrilled to be on board and to be a part of all of that. The weekly message that all the ministers will be mentioning, at least this one line, is a line from our Declaration of Principles. We don't have a lot of rules or theology, but we have this glorious statements of what we believe, and we've named that the Declaration of Principles for our teaching. And this is the one line we're looking at this morning. This is what inspired me and got me all excited to create this message. Holmes said, "We believe that God is personal to all who feel the indwelling presence." When Cerise was singing just a moment ago, that's what she was talking about. That's what the lyrics to that music are speaking to. That there is a power and a presence in this universe that is greater than we are, and sometimes we call that presence God, and it is personal to all of us, each and every one of us, as we connect to feeling and sensing and recognizing that indwelling presence. She said in the song, it abides in me, and I like that idea very much. And so I am playing in a book that you might be quite familiar with, because several of the classes we teach will call on it. It used to be a part of our foundation requirement. It was one of the two texts we used in teaching the foundation class, and it's called Living the Science of Mind. And when I was new and young and growing up in this teaching, I was told that the Science of Mind textbook might seem a little cumbersome at first, but if you read it with Living the Science of Mind, it's in a more understandable language. And I found that to be really true. But as I have played with it through the years, what I found is it's so much more than that. It's an amazing book that has a really gorgeous look, and it's sort of interesting in the way it's put together. And what I'm going to focus on today from that book comes from two of the earlier chapters, starting around page 58 or so in that book. There's a chapter Ernest wrote on sort of the history of New Thought, his perspective of New Thought. And then a couple chapters later, he has a beautiful writing on the beginning of religious science, that this philosophy, the science of mind, from his perspective, how it all came to be. And so I'm going to give you a little overview of that. But I want to, before I do that, I want to start with the quote I read in that part of the book, Living the Science of Mind, where Holmes was talking about this idea of only one. And Pat Wills, watch how sweetly it complements the quote you chose from a different book. The varying faiths of humankind are unnumbered, but the primal truth is one faith. It is an instinctive reliance upon the unseen, which we call God. Religion is one. Faith is one. Truth is one. There is one reality at the heart of all religions, whether their name be Hindu, Muslim, Christian, or Jewish, or anything else. One faith, one truth. And so, as we look this morning at sort of a deeper view of how we can use that, and I'm going to approach it like I like to do. I'm going to come at it in a slightly different way than when I usually speak about oneness, which I think is difficult for us to have an intellectual understanding of because it really is just, it's all about the experience of it, right? But I want to approach it slightly different today, and I want to start by saying that when you look at the history, and I love that book. It's been out of print for a long, long time, and every time I look on Amazon, the used copies get a little more expensive because they're probably because I talk about it so much, and then everybody runs out to try to buy it. But I love that book, and I love studying Ernest Holmes as the man. And I think, though he certainly, we don't want to elevate him, the gorgeous part about this brilliant human being is that he didn't ever want to be set aside or higher than anyone else. And so if you look at his childhood and the way he was raised, we see that the parents of all these sons, he had eight brothers. It was a total of nine boys in this little farmhouse in northern Maine. And what we know is that the mom, Anna, and the dad, William, had a very unique way of raising these boys in terms of spirituality. So they had this idea that they didn't want any religious fears taught in their home or pushed on their sons. And they were very intent on seeing that these boys could be raised with such freedom of thinking around religious matters that they would be reared in an environment that was free of superstition, free of religious, what they referred to as religious ignorance, and free of fear and guilt, and that fear and guilt would be no part of their religious experience. How cool is that? Wouldn't that be great if more of us had been, reared in such a manner that we could have a slightly, that we didn't have so much to heal, doggone it. So the thing about their approach, Anna and William's approach to raising these kids at that time, Ernest was born in 1887 and he was the youngest of all the kids. So look at that turn of that century. And the thing is that they were also probably considered to be a fairly decent Christian family. Because they went to church every Sunday. But you know what you do. Back then, you hitch the horse to the wagon, you throw all the kids, bundle up if it's winter, and you ride to town to the only building that is called church, and everybody gets the same experience. So they must have put a lot of effort into training those boys to be able to sit in that church environment and not be touched by any sermons around lowliness or sinning, your sinners, or hellfire, or any of those things. And so I applaud them. Now, of course, they do say that, and I learned this in that book, that Anna, mom, was a bit spunky about all of it, and that any time they got a new preacher man in town, because, you know, that had to happen every now and then, she would hitch that wagon and get herself to town to have a sit-down with the brand-new minister, brand-new preacher, and she would give him what ho as to how she expected her kids to be treated there and what she wanted out of the experience. But, you know, that's not to say that they didn't also hear a lot of the hellfire stuff while they were, and others, sinning and all that, while they were having that experience of church, But I think he reflects beautifully on how well mom and dad reared those children to be open-minded enough not to just be hateful about it. You know, there has to be a balance. How can we be clear in what we teach and what we believe without putting other people down? And I think that they did a really fine job based on the outcome of the what we know of all the boys. So here's a church-going family. They read the Bible every day together, usually at bedtime before they went to bed. They prayed together, and they said grace before every meal. But they did this all in their own unique way. It's a great gift. It's a great example of what can be. And when Ernest Holmes was around 18 years old, 17 to 20 years old, we don't know for sure, but he discovered Ralph Waldo Emerson. Now, Holmes was already an avid student of truth and loved the idea of spiritual communion with the divine, and he really got that idea of a personal indwelling presence. But when he read Emerson, the one thing that really dawned upon him was this idea that there is a way that we can believe in the unity or believe in this idea of unity as a foundation for all spiritual paths. Back to one, only one. And then once he got so excited about that, the way that opened his life to deepen in his own spiritual studies and hungry for what he always said that reading Emerson was like drinking water. It was so essential to his soul. So this now threw him in a new direction of desiring to look at all these great spiritual traditions and find that truth that Emerson spoke to. And that's what he did. He dedicated his entire life. He never quit loving the exploration of spirituality in many forms. He was so open at the top, such a beautiful example of that. So Ernest Holmes, who is the founder of this philosophy, intuitively felt that there had to be a way to sort of pull the great thought of all the ages and pull it together into some sort of a system. That's what he did. He created a system of thought or a methodology for spiritual living, and he packaged it in this organization or this teaching that we call the Science of Mind. And here we are today. He didn't think it would last this long, but he did a good job of identifying those eternal truths and using them, packaging them in such a way that we can use it in terms of living our lives in this sort of practical spirituality and being open to all kinds of possibilities and transformational experiences and just welcoming more and more good in our lives. That's what makes us better people, I think. So he didn't intend to ever make a new faith or start a new church. He was very clear that God did not speak to him. God did not give him any special revelations. He was not a prophet. He was just a guy who was bright, and he loved what he was doing, and he did have that intuitive ability to sense not only the indwelling presence, but to recognize it everywhere in life. And so something happened that people took to it, and he was able to create something that we today still value. He wasn't very saintly. You know, they say he was pretty average and in many ways, even though he seems to have some special characteristics. But he certainly wasn't, never intended to be a charismatic religious leader, you know. He did have some charisma. He had studied at the Leland Powers School of Elocution and learned at what was at the time how to do these dramatic readings, which they say made it very pleasing to listen to him when he spoke. So not only did he have a good message, but he had a dynamic presentation, and he was well-loved in those years that he filled theaters in Los Angeles and presented this great message. In his own words, listen to how he, in this same book, Living the Science of Mind, in his own words, this is what he said. Probably no one could have had less desire than I to organize or launch a new religion. I am a great believer in all religions, and I am firmly convinced that every man's faith is good for him, and that the form it takes is best for him at the particular time that he follows such a form. Normally, I try and clean up those quotes and make them a little more gender neutral, but I thought this one was pretty powerful if I just left it the way it was. You know, I am a great believer in all religions, and everybody has their own way. Everybody has their own faith. And I like that he not only is saying that it's about a specific faith or religious belief, but it's that it's whatever particular time you land in a certain place, you will then be open to whatever that gift of receiving is. And I think that when we're looking at this idea of only one truth, that's really the message I want to say today. It seems logical to me, and I know I'm not alone, that truth cannot belong to just any one faith. You know, that there can't be any one individual that received this divine information that's any holier than anybody else, and yet we do see characters and great, great examples of those who captured it and embodied this great truth and attempted to share it and teach it, and always in a unique way based upon the culture or the region that that person presented at any given time in history. So we have this idea that religion is just a group of people's idea about God. Religion is a way that we can look at principle. And we, as a part of Centers for Spiritual Living, formerly Religious Science, we are the same thing. We have a religion. We have ideas about God. We have a way we walk with this philosophy, but we attach science to it. So we've got the religion, and now we put this together with the science. And science is a knowledge of certain facts, of certain causes and principles. And the beautiful thing that we do through this philosophy is we have an emphasis for the way we can learn it, study it, and then prove it. You work it, and then as you have the experience of it, it deepens our faith and our conviction for it. So Holmes said once, religious science is the outcome of what has gone before, of all those great thinkers and all the stuff we've collected. It is the outcome of this philosophy. It is the outcome of what has gone before, and we believe it is a forerunner of what is to come. And he said that way back in the beginning. You know, he first started publishing books in 1919, so he's been saying it a long time, but think about it. We are a forerunner of that which is the future is coming, and I believe that is the time we are living in right now, is that this philosophy there has not been a better time in history for us to welcome such a teaching, and what a privilege it is for us to just have that as a part of what we believe. So it's not about religious science or science of mind or new thought. It's not about any of that. And yet, I notice that some of the big time preachers on TV are sort of mimicking what we have been doing for a long, long time. They're lightening up on guilt and fear because guess what? People are done with guilt. Some people, not everybody. You know, fear, some people thrive on it. But, you know, let's face it, fear is contagious. And so when I'm noticing something's going on in my life, and I can stop myself and say, wait a minute, that's a fear thought. I just noticed that move through your head. That's a fear thought. That's not my thought. I don't have to think that way. How else can I direct my focus? And man, I changed my life around in that very instant. So I think that, more than ever before, we have this gorgeous approach to spirituality that sustains life in every way. You know, we're for life, we're for love, we're for peace and joy and the experience of goodness in our day-to-day experience. So it is a method of practical spirituality. There is only one source for all those avenues of good. It is the same source for all, no matter what you believe, no matter how you worship, no matter what church or temple or synagogue you go to. It is the same source for all. Every one of us, every human being draws from that same source of intelligence in the universe. It is like there is this fountain of knowledge. And, you know, we call that intelligence God. You know, some of us, not all of us, we call that God. That's what God is. And so we are all, in our own way, tapping into that fountain of knowledge and using it in our own way. Because why? We are individualized expressions of the One. There is only one mind. There's not my mind and God's mind. That would be two minds. You know, there is only one mind, and we are all tapping into it. And so we all have equal opportunity if we use it. Right? And that's what we're about here. So let me give you a couple of examples. Holmes said that we can only, you know how he always says that, you can only take it, you know, you can only dip a pint dipper out of the bucket, and if you want more than a pint dipper, you got to have a bigger dipper, right? Or you got to build up the sides of the bucket if you want more water from the well in your bucket. So he says, in this reading, he said, we can only receive that which we inwardly listen to. We can only receive that which we tune into in that inward way. This is the aspect of the indwelling presence that we're looking at now. So I was thinking, as I was playing with these ideas, I thought, well, think about it. The scientist discovers the laws of science, the natural laws of science, because the scientist is open to that. That's the part of that infinite intelligence, that fountain of wisdom, that really excites the scientist. And so the scientist can dive deep in what he or she is studying or exploring. But the artist, on the other hand, is probably not going to be interested in the same things that would turn on the scientist. The artist has some ability to tap into that essence of beauty. The artist senses the detail of color and light and contrasts, you know? And the artist then can create art by tapping into that little thread of the infinite intelligence. The composer, think about it. You know, I get totally blown away to think of how a symphony could come to somebody who's writing music. You know, how do you talk about inward hearing, that inner hearing, you know? So you hear that, but you have a sense of the way a lot of instruments played by a lot of different musicians could come together and create harmony and beauty, and there's order to that, and there's rhythm and all those things that are involved in music. So the composer can create great music, but the athlete understands how the human body works. The athlete is really in tune with the power and the precision and that which is possible in the human body. So all of these are avenues, and guess what? It's infinite, you know, and that's why we all have different gifts. We all aren't going to be good musically. I wish I was. I'd love to sing. But we don't all get that, you know? So our purpose in life is to uncover whatever that is, so that we can fill our heart's desire, we can be satisfied, and we can then, if we're doing what we are called to do, we can sit in here on Sunday morning and listen to Cerise, and we can feel the way that she has tapped into that part of the fountain of wisdom that is hers, that gift that is hers. And she can then carry us through music and through writing music and singing music and even when you hum, it's gorgeous. I just don't understand. A little less of other talents and a little bit of that. I would have really loved that. But what we see is that we each have that access, but it matters what we listen to, what we inwardly listen to. It matters how we poise ourselves in this great experience of living to take what is ours, or to get filled up. If we are a vessel, to imagine that we get filled up with it. But each one of us is drawing from the very same source. Only one. We are each drawing from that very same source. And the thing is, don't forget that source, we say God is that it's there's this givingness that is endless. So good is always pouring, but do we have our vessel open to receive? Because, you know, Spirit cannot withhold the givingness. That's always just pouring and moving through this glorious universe, and our job is to grab a little piece of it and to get uplifted and to have some fun with it. So each is given according to his or her ability to conceive that, first of all, it's possible to receive more. You've got to be able to imagine it, to begin to conceive that it's possible. So the artist has to have a great ability to conceive or to perceive beauty in life. And then as the artist opens up to the experience of that beauty, then the gift of being able to replicate what the artist is feeling is a God-given gift, right? The composer, by way of that inner hearing, can conceive of a masterful symphony and is able to sort of catch that and somehow write it down and then orchestrate a group of people to create gorgeous music. But each receives according to their ability to conceive, imagine, to open to that flow. So the athlete, the artist, the composer, the scientist, they're all working at what they do best. And the interesting thing, if you watch people who are really honed in to doing what they're good at, if you watch them work, you will witness incredible things. You know, the people, the scientist or the mathematician or even the artist, they're never there. They never accomplish what they want. They're always diving deeper. They're always looking for a new technique or a way to refine their skills. They're always open to improving what they do. And why is that? You know, it's because when we cultivate our gifts, when we figure out what our gift is, and then we cultivate it, and we take in more information, and we refine it, and we get really good at it, we enjoy doing it more. It gives us pleasure to have the experience of bringing that gift into expression on this planet. I was thinking about golfing. I don't know why. I don't golf. I don't know why. Now, where are you, Mr. Dean? Are you sitting behind my husband?
I'm behind him and I can't see a thing.
I was just going to say, how could you even see me? So I was thinking about golfing, and maybe it's because they've written so many good books on the spiritual aspects of golfing, and I don't golf. I did take a lesson in college once. But Dean, you know, I know some people go leave the Phoenix area for cooler climate so they can golf year-round, but I want to tell you a little story, and I didn't have time to double-check this with my honey, so correct me, honey, if I get off base too far. Only just correct me a little bit. Don't correct me too much. When we lived in Thailand, Hugh went golfing. And in Thailand, it's like jungle. And it's hot and it's humid pretty much all the time. And it was so hot and humid that even the inside of my mouth felt sort of sticky all the time. It was weird. And he was entertaining some guests that were prospective clients, I guess. And they decide they're all going to go golfing, and Hugh enjoys or used to enjoy a good game of golf. You know, honey, you have not tried to do that in a long time. We live in the golf capital of you have golfed here lots of times.
He outgrew it.
Okay. There you go. So, Dean, I want you to hear this, Dean. So when Hugh went golfing in Thailand, you get a woman to be your caddy, these little petite Thai women. Oh, he's interested now. Yeah. And you don't get no golf cart. You walk through the course, and it's really hot there. And do you know what your caddy does in addition to carrying your clubs? She walks ahead of you to make sure you don't step on a cobra. Right? So you go ahead. You go off to your little trip and golf in the cool of it. We, those of us who are more hardy, will stay here year-round and we'll do as whatever we desire.
I
Oh, three little girls, excuse me. But they weren't little girls. Oh, yes. One carried your golf bag, one carries the umbrella, and the third one looks for the snakes. Okay. And that's how you golf in Thailand. All right. I'm sorry, Dean. It was just a good... Yes. There you go. All right. So let's say you enjoy golfing or you're trying to understand someone in your life who enjoys golfing. And what happens first is, you know, most people are not born Tiger Woods, you know, just great golfers. Most people learn. What happens before you learn is that you have a desire. We have a desire somehow within us. Some interest is sparked, and we begin to open to the possibilities. And so whether it's the sport, the game itself, or the glorious environment, I mean, that gorgeous park setting, and you just want to be out in nature walking around in all that beauty, it doesn't matter. It starts with a desire, and then maybe a friend shows you how. Maybe you go hit a few holes with a friend. We used to have a 9-hole course back home. That was hard to say. What? Is that what they call it? We called it a 9-hole course, and we were proud of it, I think. So you get a half a round, I guess, is how that works out. So you go and you play. Maybe you take a class on it, like I did. Or maybe you decide to have some private lessons, and you learn some skills. And then what do? You practice. You know, I mean, I'm amazed at how many homes I have visited with people who actually have a putting green in their backyard. So you practice because it's fun, right? And you want to get good at what you're doing. And I think that there's some point for those people who really got they really get bitten and you really want to golf and you really want to master it. And whether it's golf or anything else, follow along here. There's some real important lesson here. That what happens at some point is your level of skill gets so good that you have now sort of a magical experience where you just get in the zone. That's how a hole-in-one happens. You just get in the zone, and everything is favorable for that. So the golfer, you might say, is tapping into that flow of wisdom that is about being very skilled and good at that particular game. So if I want to have, let's put it now in spiritual terms. Let's say that I desire to have, which I think most of us could agree with this, I desire to have a little more peace in my life. In fact, let's say we want a little more peace and a little more love in our life. Then what I see is I recognize the desire, and if I go around just being angry at all the things that are not peaceful and loving, I'm not going to be creating a very good experience for myself, and I'm certainly not tapping into the divine fountain of gorgeous wisdom flowing. How can you be open to the gifts when you're constricting back and focused on something that is not complementary to the desire you're actually feeling? So I'm gonna create an environment where I can begin to conceive of that divine peace and that divine love in my life. Begin to imagine it and to imagine that maybe it's possible for me to tap into that and have that, and maybe I'm going to do more. I'm going to read. I've certainly got a few books on it. So I could open up some books and I could read. Maybe I'm going to join a study group. Do you know we have the most amazing Saturday morning study group? What time? 9?
9 a.m.
9 a.m. My goodness, I was here doing business, and as I walked out to leave, there was this massive circle of gorgeous, glowing souls deeply enmeshed in this study of A Course in Love, A Course of Love. What are we, the second group in the Phoenix Valley to start? We're the first one, yay. We're the first group to do that. And all they do is read this book and talk about love and what that means and how to use it in our lives. So you take a class or you study or you read or you pray about it, but you create an environment and then you begin to practice like an athlete would to use those skills until you get really comfortable at it, and it creates more peace and love and joy in your life. The primary element to that is remembering that we receive it according to how well we can imagine it, conceive it, and draw it toward us. So we are each drawing from that same source of all knowledge, and it is that which we, as Holmes said, we inwardly listen to it, or we just imagine that it's possible, and we play in that place. Holmes said this. Listen to this gorgeous quote. Should all the wisdom of the universe be poured over us, we should still receive only that which we are ready to understand. I think we are ready to understand. And I think we just go to sleep sometimes and forget how easy it can be. The universe is a spiritual system. It is governed by spiritual laws. We teach principle here. It's not difficult, but it does respond with consistent effort. The idea that we can create a world that works for everyone, that there is a way that each individual person can have a personal relationship with that indwelling presence. These are the things of which we stand upon. These are the truths that we offer and teach and practice in our own lives. Because when we do that, we just get that. We clear things away so we can intuitively feel that there is something in this great universe that is calling us to be clearer. There is a way we then rise in that communion with that one in which we sense that connection and that creative power and the authority of spirit itself in our own life. If we have a religion, and I would say that, well, we have to for all the legal reasons, but if we have a religion and if we have a theology, what I would say is that we have a religion of joy. We have a faith that is free from fear. And our religion is a way of life that we live in every day, that we are willing to go day by day and apply spiritual principle to every step that we take. And I would say that it is time indeed for us to wake up in a more global way. I see this way that we want to wake up and not be living our life for some great heavenly reward that's to unfold at some time in the future. I say that it's time for us to set aside the fear that we should. I just dread the idea that we live in fear in any way, that we are afraid of displeasing God because we are afraid of eternal damnation. I say, along with Anna Holmes, let us take a stand for the opposite. Let us know that love is right here in our lives, right now. Let us know that there is a fountain of wisdom, and all we have to do is open ourselves to begin to imagine it, to allow our gifts to be channeled through so that we can express in this life in the way that God intended for us to express. We can have a world that works for all. And so right now, I want to just take a breath. And I want you to think about anything that you might have heard this morning that has touched your soul, that has created a sense of desire for the goodness of God that needs to be more clearly present on this world. What little tidbit of truth is yours this day? Let us just anchor this in prayer right now. Oh, I just feel the love of God in this room. I can sense the movement of life itself. Awake and aware that there is a power, there is a presence, there is an infinite intelligence. It is the fountain of wisdom from which all goodness comes. It is that which we tap into. It is the source of every good gift. And it matters not what we believe, what we stand for, how we worship. It is truth. It is that presence and that power that is right here, right now, exactly where we are. It is the love of God, and it abides at the very center of each person sitting in a chair this day. It is that activity of life that is the truth of every living being. And as I sense that glorious union, that oneness with life itself, the way in which we feel stirred from the inside into that almighty inspiration that pulls us, it draws us to show up in a greater and greater way, to open our hearts and our minds in ways that we have never opened before. I feel that love of God, and I know it is the truth of all the ages. It is that golden thread of truth that exists in every faith, in every spiritual tradition, in every house of worship. It is that unifying force for good. And so this day, as we stand renewed and uplifted and open to be accountable for that which is ours, we simply know that this work is not hard to do because we are sourced constantly from that ongoing givingness of God itself. And so even now we open ourselves to be a vessel so that we can just fill up with all of that goodness. We receive the gifts of the Father, for it is the Father's good pleasure. I feel that stir of love within me, and I know that indeed it is heaven, and that we as human beings walking in finite form, as we one with the divine, that we become that intersection of heaven and earth, that we are that individualized expression of life, and that as spirit desires, we bring all of that light and that love and more peace and more joy and goodness into this planet in a way that can be felt and seen and known. And so I know there is a healing going on. I know there is a healing going on. It is the revealing of this eternal truth that every cell of our being is filled with a DNA of spirit itself. It knows how to heal us and whole us. It knows how to bless our relationships. It knows how to guide us through any sense of limitation so we might be restored to see the wholeness, the beauty, the magnificence, the lavishness of life itself. And so I say thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, Holy Spirit, for this newfound awareness, for this way we return to love and truth, and we walk in joy with our heads held high. And it is in this deep spirit of gratitude that I just release these words into that law that only says yes. I let it be, and together we say, and so it is.
Singing your favorite song?
Ooh, ooh.
Well, one of them.
Yes. Great way to end.
I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. Makes me feel so good. I could do most. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. Makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. Now I'm loving every living thing. I can see the face of God in paupers and kings. And we're all precious, no one less or more. And we've all got the same treasures in store. That's why I'm loving every living thing. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. I can't help it. makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. Now I'm believing in my guiding light. No matter what comes, it'll always turn out right. I just dig right down to how I feel. Take a deep breath and I grab the wheel. I'm believing in my guiding light. Yeah, I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. Yeah, makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. Now I'm rising to a higher place. I've got the wind in my back, there's a smile upon my face. And I'm living my dreams a little more each day. And it keeps getting easier to find my way. I'm rising to a higher place. Yeah, I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. I can't help it. Makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. I can't help it. God makes me want to sing. Yeah. Makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. Makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. Makes me feel so good. I could do most anything. Yeah.
Yay.
Fabulous. Fabulous. What a fun day. That was fun. I love kids. I love kids. We should all. You'll find it in your program, and we just know that we empower those words when we say it out loud together. Let's do that now. I live in a consciousness of good. Divine love blesses and multiplies all that I am, all that I have, all that I give, and all that I receive. Thank you, God, and so it is. Amen.